From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's All Music Show, we take a deep dive into the 50th anniversary reissue of the Beatles' White Album. Then the members of the hip-hop duo known as They aren't afraid to talk about mental health in their music.
Whether you're an artist or a listener, taking care of yourself is most important. I know being out in LA is one of those things that will give you so much pressure in, externally and internally, that it's sometimes really hard to cope with.
And a Spanish singer named Rosalia gives flamenco a modern twist. All that coming up on the Friday edition of The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, streaming now only on Netflix.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. It's nearly the 50th anniversary of the release of what's commonly known as the Beatles' White Album. And like last year's remodeled version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the White Album is on sale for about $140 in a newly remixed version. And the deluxe collection, 6 CDs and 1 DVD, is sure to satisfy even the nerdiest of Beatles fans. In honor of its release, we wanted to talk about the significance of the White Album and what it took to make those tracks sound so spontaneous. John Pareles is the chief pop music critic for the New York Times, and when I reached him by phone today, I asked Pareles how the White Album was fundamentally different from the Beatles' preceding work.
This was the big album statement after Sgt. Pepper, and Sgt. Pepper was this big fantasy edifice with orchestras and strange-sounding instruments. The White Album, by contrast, was we're going to go in and play like a band again. So you hear organs and pianos and guitars and things you recognize. There's still plenty of orchestral arrangements in there, but the mood is a band in a room. It's a really great illusion because when you read through the notes on this album, you realize how elaborately just what every track was constructed.
If you were to open up this package, this anniversary edition, what would you hear that might be surprising? Because there's a lot of new musical content, but there's also a lot of text and annotations as well, right?
Well, first of all, you need a forklift to lift the thing. Everything is annotated. There are annotations on how they made the package. There's a complete recording history of every song, which is which take they used, who was on which track. I mean, it's a monstrous amount of scholarship. And if you want to geek out that much, you can. I mean, part of the charm of it is you can hear now how hard they worked on these songs. There's take 102 of a song that they threw out. That's how hard they worked on this album. They did 100 takes of a song and decided not to use it in the end. It's also, they know you have the White Album. They know you already have a copy of the White Album. So instead of doing yet another remaster of it, they went back into the very master tapes and fooled around with them. And that's the wildest thing about this collection, I think, is that they moved the instruments around. They changed what you hear slightly so that this album has been familiar to me for 50 years. Suddenly you're picking out new details.
You mentioned in your New York Times article that while the album sounds casual, it was actually a painstaking process. How hard was it for them to sound casual, even though they were working very hard at that?
They were the Beatles, so, you know, there was magic in the room. I think there was, by, you know, historical accounts, there was friction at times between them, but the sessions they've chosen to put on show them encouraging each other, and they'll be in take, you know, 45 or take 67, they'll be saying, no, we can do a better one, I like that part. You know, they're a team. George Martin, their producer, apparently had young kids and wanted to go home before dawn, and at one point dropped out of the recording and left someone else to produce. You know, they did wear out people, but the Beatles themselves, they were working. One session that they talk about in the notes was the night of John Lennon's 28th birthday. By the time the sun rose, he was 28. So, I mean, this is what they wanted to be doing. And they decided that the way to sound like a band playing together was to be a band playing together.
I want to play one of my favorite songs from the album. It's Back in the USSR.
Flew in from Miami Beach, BOAC. Didn't get to bed last night.
So if you know that song and then you listen to what went into it, does it change your understanding of the song? Can you actually kind of rediscover a song that you already thought you knew pretty well in a new way?
I mean, the thing about an album that gets familiar is you don't really hear it anymore. You sort of hear your memory of it and where you were when you were playing it. And so when something like this comes out, if you're a big Beatles fan, you put on your headphones and you really start taking it apart again, and it becomes this different experience. So back in the USSR, the notes tell me, and the listing confirms it, they were layering in the sound of the jet plane.
Right.
And in the mono mix, the jet plane, and they were doing it somehow live as they were mixing it on top of the existing tracks. So the jet plane is different in the mono version and the stereo version. And the technician who was playing the tape loop of the jet plane apparently stretched it by the time they did the stereo version, so it sounds different. I mean, this is the level of minute scholarship they've gone into with this album.
In addition to the White Album, I see that Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland is also getting a 50th anniversary release, and Bob Dylan has just released an expanded edition of Blood on the Tracks. I'm sure there's a little bit of money to be made on these anniversaries, but is it possible that other re-releases, especially Dylan, will add to our knowledge and appreciation and understanding of the music?
Well, Dylan, definitely, because that's just a treasure trove. He recorded it all in New York, made test pressing, sent it out, was ready to go, and he said, wait a minute, you know, it's too monolithic. And he went to Minneapolis and recorded Tangled Up in Blue and four other songs and totally transformed the album. The Blood on the Tracks reissue restores those New York sessions, and the New York versions of those songs are really straight to the bone. You really feel that they're very close to the time he wrote them. They're very intense. I mean, I'm still plunging into Electric Ladyland, but there's a whole album of early takes of Electric Ladyland, and I'm sure every guitarist who cares about Jimi Hendrix, which should be every guitarist, is going to want to plunge in there and figure out, how did he do that?
John Pareles is the chief pop music critic for the New York Times. We caught up with him at his house in New York. And since we're talking about Tangled Up in Blue, let's listen to it as we go out. John, thanks so much for coming on the show. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And you're hearing an alternate version of Tangled Up in Blue from Bob Dylan's new collection titled More Blood, More Tracks. Up next on The Frame, a hip-hop duo whose influences include grunge bands like Nirvana.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting LA's Uncabaret, celebrating 25 years with this one-time-only evening of live comedy, music, and never-before-seen footage from the vault. Featuring Beth Lapidus, Julia Sweeney, Janine Garofalo, Bob Odenkirk, Greg Barron, and Jill Soloway. Also featuring Maria Bamford, Julie Goldman, Byron Bowers, Justin Sayer, and surprise guests. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Music producer Dante Jones forged his career in Hollywood by working for artists ranging from Aluna George to Kelly Clarkson. Everything changed when he met singer Drew Love in 2015. Within 6 months, they had formed the hip-hop duo known as They and released a three-song EP called New Religion. Their versatile guitar-heavy sound caught the attention of hip-hop and EDM musicians across town, sparking collaborations with the likes of Vic Mensa, Ty Dolla $ign, and Skrillex, to name a few. When I spoke with Dante Jones and Drew Love recently, they started by telling me about how living in L.A. has influenced their music and their careers.
When you're in an environment like this, especially in the entertainment industry, it really shows you what you're made of. You know what I'm saying? It really, I feel like, you know, people say, you know, when you come to like Hollywood or, you know, L.A., like, oh, people act different. I think really it just amplifies those weird little characteristics about people that were always there.
But you never forget, one thing about L.A., if you weren't from here and you migrated out from somewhere else to try to, you know, achieve a dream, you can always remember where you came from. And then you go sit and look at the beach. Like, I'm from Maryland, for example. Dante from Denver. You know what I mean? Like, you go and sit on Santa Monica Beach, sit on the pier, or you know, stand on top and look at the Hollywood sign. You're just like, I've came a long way.
How do you approach your own music differently when you're playing it live? Do you rediscover songs when you're in front of an audience? Does the experience change for you as opposed to doing something in a studio where it might just be a couple of people listening in?
You know, all right, so when I create a song, I'm thinking not only just like for what it is, but like the energy, like the that it gives off. Like, what is it supposed to convey? What's the functionality of the song? So even a song like that we dropped earlier this year called Thrive, like, it was very in your face. Like, that's what we want. We want it to be as in your face, as hard, as aggressive, as progressive as possible. And maybe that didn't translate to like, oh, becoming a massive success. But when we perform that song live, like, you feel that energy. Everything that we intended for that song to be is right there when you see it in a live performance. And there's a lot of people, like, some, you know, they'll be a They fan, but like I said, that's like a deep cut. But when that song comes on live, like, everybody erupts. It doesn't matter who you are. If you know who we are, we just did Red Rocks. And like, you know, probably, if they knew us, they probably didn't know that song. But the whole entire Red Rocks was going crazy, jumping up to that one song. So I think it's like, you know, some songs just have different functionality. And I think that, some are just going to translate live better than they do on record, you know?
I want to play a song off the new EP. It's called Broken, and it features Jesse Reyes.
Some ways to say, it's like I'm looking for someone to save me, someone to blame, so I can cry and ask you why you break me.
There is a lot going on in this song. If you played more of it, you'd hear a little bit of grunge, different kinds of musical influences. Was that something that was important to you, that you guys saw music as this very expansive idea that included bands as distinct as Nirvana in terms of things that you felt were important to represent musically?
You know, with us, it's like, we don't really think in the lines of genres. You know what I'm saying? It's like, we don't really try to think, oh, well, this has to fit this or this. It's like, really, what does this song need? I think, for me as a producer, I've always made like guitar-driven music. That's just been like the foundation of what I did. One of my first places was with Kelly Clarkson. And
this is Mr. Know-It-All, right?
Mr. Know-It-All, yeah, which was like a crazy experience for me. That was my introduction to LA, like, within the first week. But I think that, like, for us, is there's really just no boundaries, you know what I'm saying? And there's like, you know, so many different inspirations and so many, like I said, it's about the energy. What energy am I trying to put out through my music? And if it takes a particular instrument, then so what? Like, I don't care. At the end of the day, it's about, like, when you hear this product, do you feel it? And you feel the spirit that we're trying to put out there.
Drew, I want to play a song called Tell Me that features Vic Mensa.
Somebody tell me what to live for. Knocking at the same doors, can't get in. I'm dying just to get more. Screaming at the sky, Lord,
I'm a prisoner in my mind. I live inside of my pain.
There's been a lot of talk about self-care in music and in rap and hip-hop. And Vic has talked a lot about this, about taking care of yourself. It's right. Not something a lot of people are willing to talk about or discuss.
Yeah.
And that's part of this song, too, isn't it? Why is that important to you?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, because whether you're an artist or a listener, anybody, you know what I mean? Like, taking care of yourself is most important, because there's a lot of things. I know, going back to an early question you talked about, like, being out in LA is one of those things that'll give you so much pressure externally and internally that it's sometimes really hard to cope with and deal with. You know what I mean? Before you know it, all of a sudden, like, you know, you're up to the brim with pressure and anxiety that you don't know how to deal with. So you always have to take care of yourself, make sure that you love yourself first and foremost, go out and do different things that allow you to release that pressure. Because you put too much pressure on yourself, and before you know it, that's why you see a lot of these artists out here that are, you know, unfortunately pass away due to different, you know, personal health problems, you know, things like that, that maybe if they could have found a way to talk to somebody or help themselves a little bit better, you know, we wouldn't be talking about some of the things that we're talking about. So I think it's really important. Tell Me was a song that came together really organically. Because it was a song that me and Dante kind of started. We were kind of feeling that kind of pressure for a little bit. We were kind of in a little bit of a rut. We made that song, and it was a little bit open. We had an open verse, and I remember when we were putting the project together, I was like, oh man, because I'd seen some of the things that Vic was saying and the way that Vic speaks, and personally as an artist, I just respect him so much from a lyrical level. I was like, oh, he would sound perfect on this. And so when I sent it to him, he sent me the verse right back, and the song was done. So
we're talking with Dante Jones and Drew Love about their duo called They. Dante, I want to play a song that came out earlier this year. It's called Pops.
Sometimes I wish I still had you to keep me on my toes. How it feel, Pops?
There's also a beautiful music video to this song about a young man at a funeral, and we don't really know who has died. I want to ask you about the origins of that song, because it feels very personal to one of you. I'm not sure which.
Right. Well, I mean, it's kind of a composite story. I mean, obviously, like, my dad drove a Plymouth, you know, but at the same time, it's like it's still our story. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, it's funny. That song came together a little over a year ago when we first wrote it. It was actually my dad's birthday, and I was talking to him on the way to the session. We get into the session. It's a new guy that we hadn't worked with. And for whatever reason, I was just kind of thinking about, like, you know, just mortality and just, like, that part of it. So when we started writing the song, I kind of approached, like, yo, what if we wrote about, like, our mm-hmm. relationship with our dads? And, yeah, so it came together really quickly, honestly, and it was just, like, honestly, it's still one of my favorite songs that we ever written.
Wow.
Like, that's one of the songs I really sit back and I'm just, like, dang. Like,
I'd agree,
like, 100%. Like, we really wrote something special. So we revisited it about a year later. When it went in, and we're like, okay, yeah, we want to put this out around Father's Day, but we wanted the right visual to tell a story. So the visual was really my vision, because it was my story. My mother passed when I was 15, and my dad had to raise my brother and I from there on out by himself. And I just think that like the conversation that's at the end with my mom's friends, where she said, you know, you need to accept your father for who he is, because at the time, you know, I've been kind of going through, like, you know, typical teenager stuff, but I was getting in a lot of trouble. I got, you know, expelled, and obviously my mom passed, and it was just a crazy time in my life. But just that moment of knowing, like, okay, this is our family unit going forward, and we're going to push forward, was like something that was really like a pivotal moment in my life.
What was it like to do that song for your dad?
You know what? He actually hasn't seen it performed live yet. He watched the video. He tried to play like he didn't get emotional or whatever. But like he has a new girlfriend right now, so she was like, "Yo, he was blubbering when he watched the video." But yeah, but nah, he, you know, we're super close now. Just like we said in the song, it's like, you know, the distance between us closed from like me aging and having that better perspective on our relationship, but like. Yes, he loves the song. He loves everything. He's our biggest fan. He knows every article, every interview. He's going to listen to this interview probably.
That's
like
great.
He's Googles everything. Like he's that's all he does all day.
He's a Googler.
When you talk to other musicians and say, what do you think of Tame Impala or Vampire Weekend, do they look at you and say, what are you talking about?
No, I mean, I think within the music community, people's taste is getting broader. People are delving back a lot more. Like me personally, Dante had me delving back into the archives a lot more, digging more into the crates and expanding my musical knowledge to, you know, times before I was born, times before I was really listening to music. And even Motown was something Dante doesn't listen to that much. He had me listen to a little bit more of it because I had to go toe-to-toe with him on the musical knowledge level and stuff like that, and be able to be a part of those debates. Sometimes I got to expand my knowledge, yeah, a little bit. So,
but one thing I'll say, though, too, is that I think that maybe we're meant to be like a point of entry to a lot of those artists. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Because somebody has to bridge the gap. You can't just, I mean, obviously you could, but sometimes you need that middle ground of somebody between, like, you know, the urban music and the indie music to kind of lead somebody in. I always had that, even for like emo. For me, it was like, all right, let me start off with something easy, like Fall Out Boy. And then that leads me to Take It Back Sunday, which leads me to the next one. So that, I think that's what we strive to do too, is just to kind of inspire people to be like, okay, oh, Tame Impala, I've never heard listen to them. Let me go check that out, you know, and introduce them to it just by saying that's our biggest influence, you know.
Dante Jones and Drew Love are they. Their new EP is called Fireside. Dante and Drew, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate you, man.
You can find They on all the major streaming services. Coming up, flamenco music gets a 21st century update from the Spanish singer Rosalia.
I don't want to wait for our lives to be over. If it happened, would you take it how you left it?
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind, the story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, now streaming only on Netflix.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The Spanish singer Rosalía is an artist you'll be hearing a lot about. In the past year, her career has skyrocketed. She's recorded with Pharrell Williams and shot a part for Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar's next film. And Rosalía's modern update of traditional flamenco music brought her 5 nominations at the upcoming Latin Grammy Awards. On the eve of her new album release, The Frame contributor Beto Arcos caught up with Rosalía in Madrid.
Perhaps it's fitting that I meet Rosalía in a 16th century palace. These days, Rosalía is the equivalent of Spanish royalty. It's mid-afternoon in Madrid. Rosalía has been doing press interviews all day in a lavish salon and appears a bit frazzled. But she perks up when I tell her I just returned from walking 100 miles on the Camino de Santiago, a sacred pilgrimage in northern Spain.
Sí, es muy bonito. Con la gente que te vas cruzando, ¿verdad? Cada vez que haces...
She says she walked the Camino 5 years ago and would like to repeat the experience if she ever has free time again. Rosalía is from a small town in Catalonia. She's 25 years old and grew up listening to the music her parents played at home, the Beatles, Queen, Supertramp. Then, when she was 13, flamenco entered her consciousness.
I heard it in the street with my friends. They were like older than me. They had the cars with the doors open, hearing the music super loud in the street. They used to hear flamenco, they used to hear Camarón. Gitana, gitana, te quiero. Tú pura como la mimbre.
Tú pura como la mimbre. Yo, gitano, canate. Camarón de la Isla is considered the top flamenco figure of the 20th century.
In Camarón, it was like something that changed my life completely. It was like before and after Camarón, you know? I fall in love with this music and the way he used his voice.
Rosalía doesn't come from a musical family. She didn't know anything about flamenco when she began studying it.
And this music is so difficult, it's so difficult. I'm telling you, like, the rhythms, it's so difficult to understand at the beginning. You have to get very focused and study a lot to understand this type of music.
Rosalía says Camarón has been a major influence in her career.
He was so inspiring for my generation, and he was very open-minded. He always took risks doing his records.
Rosalía is also taking risks on her own records. Many in the traditional flamenco community criticized her first album called Los Ángeles. Among other things, she was accused by a Roma activist of cultural appropriation.
I guess that when you do something with risk, that risk makes you connect with a lot of people and not connect with a lot of people too.
José Manuel Gómez is a music critic based in Madrid. Gómez says Rosalía has engaged a new generation that has never heard flamenco before with an essential element every artist should have.
Los flamencos buenos.
The good flamenco artists will tell you the important thing is to communicate, to transmit. And Rosalía communicates. It's true, there are songs that communicate and others simply don't. But that happens with every other artist I listen to.
Rosalía's new album is a departure from the previous one. If the first album was minimalist, guitar and voice, this one has many layers of production and influences, from electronic music to R&B. It's flamenco for the 21st century, inspired by an anonymous novel from the Middle Ages called Flamenca. Rosalía says there are some traditional flamenco melodies, but there are many pieces she composed specifically for it. It's also a concept album.
And every song is a chapter. There's a whole story in the record, which is El Mal Querer, this bad loving, this story about a dark love.
Rosalía recently recorded 2 songs with singer and producer Pharrell Williams. She says it was a privilege to work with him in the studio, where she came to appreciate something special about him.
Wow, he loves flamenco too. He likes that. He was interested in that. He was like telling me that he believed in me and that he loved this culture, these flamenco melodies, that he was excited about that. And that was a surprise for me. that made me feel very happy and comfortable to make music with him.
Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar invited Rosalía to do a scene in Dolor y Gloria, his next film to be released next year.
Yeah, it was like a beautiful experience. It was my first scene in a movie. And the first scene with Almodóvar, it's kind of mind-blowing because he's my favorite artist in the world, probably.
Rosalía can only guess what the late legend Camarón de la Isla would say if he heard her music today. She certainly knows what she would say to him if she had the chance.
Because of him, I'm here. He changed my life when I was 13, and he's been like the most inspiring icon and musician from my country for me. And he's been so important. He was the door that I opened to discover all this music, and I love him.
For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos, in Madrid, Spain.
And that is it for this week. Remember, you can get this show as a podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, and Apple Podcasts. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett, with help this week from Audrey Ngo. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday. Si hay alguien que aquí se oponga.